This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars with you again here on Dreamland, and today we're very honored to have with us Stanton Friedman, probably the best known name in ufology today. He is, of course, a physicist, has worked on a lot of classified programs, and has made a study of the Betty and Barney Hill experience almost from the get-go. He's got a new book out called Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And this is the true story of the world's first documented alien abduction. And Stan, I'm very grateful and appreciative that you're here with us today. But before we get into some questions and answers, there's probably some listeners who vaguely know about Betty and Barney Hill, but can you give us a little synopsis of their story to kind of give us a foundation?
In 30 words or less, huh?
Yeah, right. Yeah, give me the history of the world.
Okay. Basically, they were driving home from Canada on September 19th, 1961. They lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is on that little bit of New Hampshire that's on the coast between Maine and Massachusetts. And they'd gone up to Niagara Falls and over to Montreal, and they were going to stay over, but then they heard there was a hurricane coming, so they headed south. And for about an hour, this is late at night, and nobody around, and it's country up there, it's not city. And they play tag, if you will, with the UFO. Betty saw it and described it, and Barney watched it. They stopped a couple of times to watch it through binoculars. And at the last one, they got scared because Barney was looking for binoculars, and he got a strong feeling that they wanted him to stay there and they were going to be captured. And so he pulled the binoculars down, actually broke the strap. He was so upset, dashed back to the car. And there's a period of missing time in here someplace because they heard strange sounds in the trunk. They heard another set of strange sounds. And they got home roughly 2 hours later than they expected to get home. I mean, there's no traffic problem in the middle of the night in New Hampshire, believe me. And, they recalled seeing the UFO, and it was right over the car and not far away. It wasn't just a light in the sky. And Betty had frightening dreams a couple of weeks later. She had gone to the library a few days after the experience and took out one of Don Kehoe's books. And it had an address in the back. If you have seen a UFO, please write us and we'll see what we can do for you. She wrote a detailed letter, and they got interrogated about a month later by Walter Webb. 6 hours he spent with them. So a lot of details came out at that time. But as time went on and they worked with other scientists and other people, it was clear that there was this missing 2 hours, which made no sense. And Barney was developing serious health problems, ulcers, and the treatment didn't seem to work, and the doctor thought he ought to see a psychiatrist. And eventually, Betty and Barney, a couple of years later, started seeing Dr. Benjamin Simon down in Boston. And they were very lucky, as it happens, because he's a world-class expert on helping people who've had traumatic experience. They didn't call it PTSD back then, but that's what it was. Shell shock war veterans. You know, people, buddy's head got blown off alongside him in a battlefield, had trouble integrating that. And Dr. Simon had developed a method involving very deep medical hypnosis. And I stress that because this wasn't parlor game stuff. And he had worked with literally thousands of war veterans after the war. I've actually seen the movie, Let There Be Light, showing his World War II experiences. He was head of a 3,000-bed hospital. And so here was a man who didn't care about flying saucers. That wasn't his interest at all. He was trying to help two people who had had an experience in which there was missing time, in which, as he took them under hypnosis separately now, all their sessions were separate and amnesia was induced after each session, and he taped the sessions. The emotional intensity in some of these sessions was greater than that in any of the military people that Dr. Simon had worked with. I've seen this on paper from him. And so he even had to stop a couple of sessions because he didn't think they could handle the emotion, the fear, the terror, whatever you want to call it. So the book, the first book about this case, they weren't looking for publicity. A guy heard a tape of this little talk they gave to a group of people and gave it to a reporter, and the reporter did a lot of nosing around and ran a series of articles in a Boston paper. And they tried to keep them from being published. They thought they'd lose their jobs. Betty was a social worker, state of New Hampshire, supervisor, welfare department. Barney worked for the post office, but was very active in civil rights affairs. Barney was black and Betty white, which was rather an unusual combination in New Hampshire in 1961, as you can imagine. And the first book, The Interrupted Journey, was a bestseller in several languages. John Fuller wrote it, and with the full critique and approval of Dr. Simon. I've seen his notes on Fuller's manuscripts at the Boston University Archives, and Simon had final say on stuff, and boy, he exercised it. He said, you can't say this, you can't say that, that would make me look foolish. I don't know how Fuller put up with it, but it probably made for a better book, a more acceptable book, if you will. Now, the book does not include the transcript of all these hypnosis sessions. Now, what's important about this book is that my co-author, who actually did most of the work, is Betty's niece, Kathleen Marden. She has all the tapes. She was the executrix of Betty's estate. Betty died in 2004. She lived close by, and for the last 10 years or so, I did a lot of interviewing of Betty and chit-chatting back and forth to check on things. And Kathleen went through a period of ups and downs about the story. She was home when Betty called Kathleen's mother the day after the experience. And so she heard about the story from the get-go, and they visited a couple days later, and she saw the spots on the trunk of Betty's car and how the compass went wild there, and we still don't have an explanation for that. But then later on, Betty was seeing UFOs everywhere. Barney died in 1969. I had dinner with Betty and Barney back in 68. Shows you how long I've been around, I guess, almost 40 years. I was very favorably impressed with them. And some people have asked me, well, how'd you get involved in this? You're not an abduction guy. Well, that's true. But I had met them. I was called in by Coral Lorenzen of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization to see if I would help a woman named Marjorie Fish, who was building three-dimensional models of the local galactic neighborhood, to see if she could find a three-dimensional pattern that matched the strange map that Betty had drawn, supposedly being shown it by an alien on board the craft. And it had stars, points of light for stars, and different kind of lines, a total of 16 stars, heavy trade routes and light trade routes and occasional expeditions. And it's in the book. I mean, it's a funny little sequence. They finished examining Betty on board the craft. Barney is in another room. And she asks the leader, I know you're not from around here, she says, the understatement of the month, where you're from. And so he shows her what I can only describe as a three-dimensional map. I'll call it a hologram. We didn't have the word at the time, but that's certainly what it sounds like. It had a 3D quality, and some of the little points of light were bigger than others and so forth. And she says, well, he shows her this thing, and 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet. And she's looking at it and says, well, where are you on the map? Wise guy alien says, do you know where you are on the map? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. You can imagine poor Dr. Simon listening to this. What's going on here? I mean, trade routes, you know? And so he gives Betty a post-hypnotic suggestion. If and only if she can draw it, if she can remember it accurately, please draw it later on. And she does that, and it's in the book. But the trouble is, how do you make any sense out of it? There's no reference point. You know, the galaxy's got a couple hundred billion stars. They're obviously not in the map. So I got called in by Coral Lorenzen of APRO to see if I could help Marjorie Fish. And because I was traveling very heavily and lecturing, I managed to arrange to see her in Ohio, where she was living and teaching third grade. She's a member of Mensa, too, incidentally, a very bright and objective person. I was very impressed with her work. She sent me handwritten materials and stuff. This is before computer times, guys. And I was with her when she made a presentation at Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the Air Force scientific consultant on UFOs, over in Chicago at the Abbott Planetarium. And I helped describe the work she did at a Mutual UFO Network symposium in Akron, Ohio. And so I was the first to publish about this star map work in the old Saga magazine, everybody's favorite magazine. And that was so well received that I suggested to Terence Dickinson, who was then the editor of Astronomy Magazine. I had met him in Rochester, New York, working at the Strassenberg Planetarium. I'd seen him another time and suggested to him and sent him my Saga magazine article that he should do an article. He talked to Marjorie. He talked to a whole bunch of other people, including Dr. George Mitchell at Ohio State University, who was helping Marjorie because the library wouldn't lend her the star catalogs. So Mitchell arranged so she could look at them and at least hand copy all the numbers in them for star positions and stuff. And to make a very long story short, she had discovered the names of all the stars when a new catalog of distance data came out. If you think about it for a minute, you realize an astronomer doesn't need a distance to look at a star. Just aim the telescope two angles and where they cross, so to speak, there's the star, whether it's 20 light years away or 40 light years away, it doesn't matter. And you get five star catalogs and get five different numbers for distances back then because they're hard to measure. But if you're going to build a model, you need accurate data. And it was only when a new catalog came out, Wilhelm Gliese from Germany, of distances, she rebuilt one of her models, and there was the pattern, angle for angle, line length for line length. Anyway, I was fascinated with her work. I published the article. Terry Dickinson published an article. It got more response than anything they'd ever published in Astronomy Magazine. Some pro, some con. And Terry, over the next year or so, this is in the mid-70s, carried about 11 letters in response to her work. Then they put together a 32-page full-color booklet, the Zeta Reticuli incident. They sold 10,000 copies immediately, which has never happened before. But then Carl Sagan threatened to sue them because his name was on the front, because he had a couple of letters in this booklet with all the letters in the original article. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and I wound up with 18,000 copies. And I just ran out last year. Sorry, guys. I wish I could put in a plug, but I don't have anything to sell. But it's a very extraordinary piece of work, and it put the spotlight on the two base stars. And for me, as a physicist who's worked on propulsion systems for deep space and stuff, I need a target. You say you want to go someplace, I want to know, so where do you want to go? And, you know, how far is it? How do we get there? All the rest of that. Well, her work pinpointed Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. It's a constellation of Reticulum, the neck, that means, in some language, either Latin or Greek. I better look it up, I guess. And these two stars are a remarkable pair. We hadn't realized it before her work. They're the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in the entire galaxy. Now, people should understand. Stars are more different from each other than people are. Some stars are huge, some are small, some are old, some are new, some are cold, some are hot. Some have another star right next to it, which gives you some crazy orbits. Within our local neighborhood, which is all I worry about, let's say within 55 light years, there's close to 2,000 stars. We keep finding small ones all the time. Of those, about 50 are Sun-like, about less than 5% actually. That's in our local neighborhood. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli now are only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. That means they're 35 times closer to each other than our star, the Sun, is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies. These guys got next door neighbors. In addition, they're a billion years older than the Sun. And one of Friedman's many laws, I make them up as I go along, is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. What that means is if somebody's got a little head start on us, you know, say a cool million years, give them only 1,000 years. They're going to know some technology we don't know. And so also, think of this situation. You're on a planet around one of these two sun-like stars, and you look at the other star. It's visible all day long because it's only an eighth of a light year away. And from a planet around one looking over at the other star, either direction, you will directly observe planets. There's no guessing the way we are right now. Although I should add, within the next 10, 15 years, we'll have some new satellites up there that are going to make great measurements, and we'll be able to observe Earth-like planets. We can't do that really right now, but it won't take long. Just as we have new distance data, the Hipparco satellite, a European space agency, not an American, not a NASA satellite, has made millions of measurements of distances, much more accurate than anything we've ever had before. So it's a very exciting piece of work, and it's only a small part of the book. And I wrote that part, and I also dealt with the, how shall I put it, the nasty, noisy negativists who have attacked the case, attacked the star map. You know, they'll always be with us. I don't need to tell you guys that. There's always a small percentage of the people who think the Earth is flat, who think there's nothing to UFOs, and have repeat all the old crazy notions. You can't get here from there. Governments can't cover things up. You can't trust eyewitness testimony. I don't know how many of the listeners saw me on the Larry King show on July 13th, but we were treated to a debunker saying that a trained observer is no better than an untrained observer. Now, what the heck is that supposed to mean? I don't know. And he wants a piece of something before he believes anything. You know, like the native in the jungle in Brazil, if he can't bring you a piece of that airplane that went by, it didn't fly by. That's ridiculous. You know, I took some of the heat off Kathleen, but the book has a lot of new stuff in it. One of the things is, and Whitley, I think you'll appreciate that, this is the fact that people have often said that hypnosis is not to be trusted because the hypnotist just pumps into the supposed abductee his version of what's going on out there. What they never do mention is that in Dr. Simon's case, he made every effort to push Barney away from an alien explanation, try to get Barney to believe that nothing really happened to him with regard to an abduction. That was just Betty's dreams that he was recycling, so to speak. And he kept fighting that. In other words, here was an instance of bias in the other direction. They won't tell you about that. And so it's a fascinating study of an important case in Betty's life, which ebbed and flowed.
It is a fascinating case, Dan. And when we come back, I want you to tell us how you view the Betty Barney Hill case today as opposed to the way you viewed it back in the 60s, if there is a difference. We'll be right back after these messages.
This week for Unknown Country subscribers, we continue on with the Crop Circle Meditation Sequence with the third meditation called The Butterfly Effect. It is based on a remarkable crop circle showing a butterfly that was made back in July and when we were first starting this process. So don't miss this. Really do not. If you are not a subscriber to Unknown Country, it is important that you do so first because we need you. That is how we get most of our support. And second, because you need this. This is valuable material. In fact, To tell you the truth, I'm amazed at just how intimately this communication seems to be going on. I can hardly believe it, but it does appear to be quite true. So do not miss this. Join unknowncountry.com today. And if you really can't even do that or don't want to, you can give us a donation, a little bit, anything will help, because this is a user and listener-supported website exclusively. It does not take outside advertising. So go on to the website, go on to unknowncountry.com, and on the right you'll see a donation box. You can put a little bit of money in that box, and that will help us get a little bit farther along down the road. And now let's get back to Jim Mars and Stanton Friedman.
Okay, we're back here. This is Jim Mars. We're on Dreamland, and today we're talking with Stanton Friedman about his new book, Captured, that deals with the Betty Barney Hill case and brings it right on up till today. Stan, before we left, I was asking if your perceptions of this case has changed any over the years since you began first investigating it back in the 60s.
Yes, it has, Jim. When I read the book and I read the two Look magazine articles by John Fuller, mid-60s, I put them in my gray basket, my old expression when I'm not sure, let's let it sit until we get more data.
Because yeah, I call that my huh file. You go, huh, and you just file it away.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then a couple of things happened. You have to understand, or listeners need to understand, that NICAP at that time, which the organization that Betty had written when she found the book in the library and the first investigator she talked to was a NICAP investigator. NICAP pretty much took the view that, yes, there are alien spacecraft flitting around the atmosphere and that the Air Force knows all about them, but basically there's nobody on board. We don't want to deal with beings. That was because of the contactees, you know, the George Adamskys talking about beautiful Venusians and all that sort of stuff. And NICAP was very much afraid of being tarred with a kind of contacting brush. Okay, once I met Betty and Barney, I was very favorably impressed. They were obviously sensible, intelligent people. They weren't looking for anything special. They were looking for attention. They were kind of forced into it because the response to those original newspaper articles and then to the book was very positive, much to their surprise. So, okay, after I met them and after I got into the star map work, and also after hearing more abduction cases, in other words, this wasn't one of a kind, the only one, et cetera, which would make it more suspect, I came around to the notion that, that not only is this story true, and I was quite favorably impressed with them. I mean, Betty's family came over in like 1635 or so, and she knows who she is, very much so. And I was very favorably impressed with Barney. Sharp, and a good sense of humor, and, you know, all the rest of those things. So, and then after the star map work, to me that validated the things, because here was something nobody knew. Nobody knew the positions of those stars when this happened. Nobody doing what Marjorie did back in 61 when the experience took place, or in 66 when the book came out, could have correctly identified those stars. And the chance that it's just coincidence, in other words, you grab 16 stars out of all the ones in the neighborhood, and they're only the right kind for planets and life, and all the right kind. The chance of that being a coincidence when only fewer than 5% are the right kind is less than 1 in 10,000. I'm a physicist. That kind of thing impresses the heck out of me. So I use this in my lectures. I talk about this story. I'm completely sold, if you will, on the legitimacy of it. And I certainly wasn't when I first heard about it. It was an interesting experience, an interesting story, but, you know, what validity did it have? Now, to me, it's kind of the model of one of the best investigated UFO cases, abduction cases. And partly, although I found it frustrating at the beginning, because Simon didn't know anything about UFOs. Now, I've listened to parts of the tapes, and one thing that's special about the book is Kathleen has included a lot of stuff from the transcripts of the tapes that's never been published before. I think a lot of people thought that Fuller had included everything. Well, he didn't. It was far too much, as you can imagine. And Carl Sagan, in an article he wrote, implied that there was one hypnosis session. There were months of separate hypnosis sessions. And one thing that Simon did, I guess it's a standard technique for guys using his particular approach, is to ask the same question several different times in slightly different ways to get them to look at things a little differently, you know, like walking around a room to describe things. And so we get the benefit of that in the book. And Kathleen thrilled the audiences at the MUFON Symposium in August by playing tapes from some of the sessions. You got a much better feeling for what was in their head, so to speak, and the tone and some of the remarkableness, if I can make up a word, of what was going on. So, yeah, my view has solidified. It's changed. It went from maybe to very definitely. And I'm still intrigued by what we can learn by listening to the answers to the questions that Simon asked, you know, about the alien curiosity and all that sort of stuff.
Right. Well, Stan, one thing I recall is that when Barney was recounting his experiences, he described the leader of the folks on board this craft as a Nazi. What do you make of that?
Well, what he was doing, remember, Simon had given instructions to, in effect, recall, relive what you were feeling and thinking and seeing, all of these. So Barney often talked, I won't call it alliteration, but what he was thinking of, what it made him think of. It's like at one point he talks about a red-haired Irishman. The way the aliens behaved, all in unison and with strong actions, and the guy was looking at him, the Nazi, so to speak, reminded him of what he'd heard about Nazis. Not that they were, that was an exact description, but what it was in his head. You
what
know, that guy
like.
Looked, yeah, what it felt like. That's as good a way as any as describing it. And so he wasn't always giving literal answers, but reflecting what was going on in his head.
How was your work with Kathleen? Did you all work well together?
Well, yeah. You know, it almost came about by accident. Part of the stimulus was that an English television production company had contacted me to see about doing a Discovery Channel piece on abductions, they said. And they wondered if I knew anybody, if there was anybody around still who knew about the Betty and Barney Hill case, a relative. So I said, well, yes, I know their niece. You see, Kathleen has been active in ufology. She handled MUFON's in field investigator certification for 10 years. This isn't somebody who just decided, oh, it's an interesting case my aunt and uncle had. Let's look into it. She's been at this for a long time. And so I mentioned Kathleen to them. They brought us both up to Lincoln, New Hampshire, which is out in the middle of nowhere. And we got together there. And one of the things that really struck me, there are two important things about that meeting. One is that when you're there, it's perfectly clear that the aliens were controlling Barney's actions mentally. That is, even though they were in a craft above his vehicle, his car, he would never have made that turn from a primary road to a secondary road to a tertiary road for no good reason at all in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, without somebody up above there forcing him to. And then you look where I stood at the exact location. You see this large, empty, well, now it's got a house there, but back then it was an area that was amongst the trees, big enough to put a saucer down in, you understand. But there aren't many areas like that around there. So that's one thing that really impressed me. And secondly, Kathy and I were strongly in agreement when the show was run on television and they gave it a label of I had sex with an alien, and they put that in the website over my face, darn it.
And you didn't even get a kiss.
No. And so we both talked about how angry we were, because on the program they had some woman who has alien lovers and some guy who's got three or four alien women. And Betty and Barney did not have sex with aliens. One or more, none, zero, no sex. Clinical interest in pregnancy maybe and sperm and stuff like that, but no sex. So as we talked about that, we realized that there was a need, and she'd been working on this for some time, to get into this story in a way which would enable us to defend the story. And I'm a heavy hitter when it comes to blasting the nasty, noisy negativists of the world. So we worked together very well. And the Internet, of course, makes a lot of this simpler. You can send chapters, you know, email things. I went down there. I spent a couple of days at Kathy's house in New Hampshire. It's over 400 miles from here in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, down to Portsmouth, well, just outside Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I went through all the files she had, and I brought down a bunch of stuff that I had sitting in my files. So when we got finished with that, we could see how we could put together a book. She wanted a physical scientist because she knew there would be attacks from the Seth Shostaks of the world, or she could handle the Susan Clancy's of the world, and we do that in the book. You know, the Harvard psychologist, PhD, who says some rather strange...
Who says that, yeah, she's the one that says abductions are sleep paralysis, right?
Yeah.
And yet she doesn't seem to notice that the vast majority of abductions take place in broad daylight with people driving down the road or wide awake.
What, you mean they're not sleeping when they're driving? I'll be darned.
What a surprise.
Yeah, so we got together very well at that, and we also talked at one of the MUFON conference we were both at and went over some of this stuff. So it was a very different collaboration from both of us. I mean, she's social sciences, and her training is in sociology and education, and I'm a physicist working on canceled classified programs. But the response, I'll tell you, I've been very pleased to find out, and I hadn't thought about it particularly, but when I was at the MUFON convention signing copies of the new book, and when I was down in Roswell just before that, when the book first came out, a lot of people told me that this was the story that got them interested in UFOs. When they read
right.
The Interrupted Journey and the Look magazine articles. And I hadn't thought about that particularly, but I have also found that the first book that got me hooked was Edward Ruppelt's book, The Report on UFOs. He had been head of Project Blue Book. That was in 1958. And I found a number of other people in ufology for whom that was also the instigating stimulus, if you will. But certainly there seem to be plenty of people who remember hearing this story, seeing it in Look magazine, and also the television portrayal, a UFO incident starring James Earl Jones in 1975. I was a consultant on that. Would you believe I was recommended to Universal Studios by the United States Air Force?
That's pretty interesting.
And I was living in Southern California, and they called the Air Force to see if they knew of any scientists in the area, and they knew of me for some reason or other.
Oh, I'm sure they had a bulging file on you. But, you know, I recall reading Fuller's book, and I'm not going to say it was the instigating factor, because there had been some instances in Texas back in the 50s and some other material that I already read. So I was already a little bit interested in UFOs, but I did read Fuller's book, and I also read those magazine articles, and it did make a big impression on me at the time. I think this was, I was probably just either about to graduate college or had just gotten out of college, and I found it that this, as you say, is one of the best documented instances that we have. Another thing, Stan, that impresses me about your new book, Captured, is that it's not just a yay Betty Barney book. You also get into some of the problem areas that occurred in recent years and in the years just prior to Betty's death. And we'll talk about these problem areas when we get back from these messages.
And you will not hear this anywhere except in our subscriber section, which, by the way, has got over 3 years of commercial-free Dreamland, hundreds of special interviews, all kinds of fascinating video, intimate video of experiences at my cabin, all sorts of things like that. It is a real treasure trove. And, of course, there's the new meditation series that I mentioned earlier. So subscribe today. Click on the unknowncountry.com subscribe tab and do it now.
This is Jim Mars. We're back here on Dreamland. We're talking to Stanton Freeman, who has co-authored a new book on Betty and Barney Hill, along with Kathleen Martin, who was Betty's niece, and probably as close to the situation as anyone could get. Stan, we were going to mention that in there, it's not a complete positive viewpoint of this whole thing. You also address not only the skeptics, but also some problem areas later in life for Betty. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. Now, Barney died in 69. Here's Betty. She's been out in the public view. She's still working as a social worker, and she's really determined, with all the garbage that was heaped on her by the noisy negativists, to vindicate the whole experience. So she went out and had people she talked to at Pease Air Force Base, for example. This is one of the things that surprised some people in the book, that there was a close social connection between Betty and Barney and the military guys at Pease Air Force Base, which is just down the street, so to speak. Betty also started investigating UFO sightings. There were places she went that she would see lights in the sky and call them all flying saucers. And she got also upset about the fact that there were too many other abductees around, if I can put it that way. That is, she thought that there were very few real abductees, that it was only when typically medical hypnosis was used. And she was accepting of Travis Walton and a few others, but she was putting down most of the others besides those simply because she thought that they didn't get careful enough medical hypnosis the way Dr. Simon had done Betty and Barney. She even wrote a book on a different approach to UFO investigation. And she wasn't really too good an investigator. And as an example, she was showing some pictures she took with Polaroid cameras, and they show a strange motion in the sky. And when I asked about the characteristics of the camera, and she said, oh, it wasn't moving when she saw it, but you see that it's moving on its own. The camera records it. We can trust the camera. Well, when I checked with Polaroid, that camera is used by artists to create pretty patterns by moving it in their hands, because the shutter stays open in a dark area, like at night in the sky, looking at the sky, for many, many, many seconds. And, you know, you can't hold a camera still for that time. And
that
so
would certainly that would produce a zigzagging streak of light, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, even though the object is not streaking. So there were a number of things like that. And Kathy went through a period of beginning to doubt some of the things about the experience. And then the real breakthrough for her came when she got access. Betty gave her the tapes, the audio tapes that Dr. Simon had made of the sessions, and she's transcribed them all and was surprised at how much material there was that hadn't been out before and where she could cross-check Betty's answers versus Barney's answers versus that dream material and stuff like that. And so that brought her back down to a vindication of Betty's story, if you will. And, you know, people who have had a UFO sighting, I'm not one of them, so I don't have to worry about this, but often are beset by the debunkers. You know, you're just making that up. That didn't really happen. Oh, people aren't good observers. You've heard all those stupid arguments.
Right.
And so they need a validation of their experience someplace along the way. It's kind of like in the Roswell experience. There was a woman named Sappho Henderson whose husband was a pilot at the base and who had told her in 1980, after stuff about Roswell started to appear in the newspapers, that he had flown some of the wreckage and he had seen the bodies. Now, Len Stringfield collected stories of crash retrievals, and he's the first to mention Sappho Henderson, but he wouldn't tell me how to reach her, and I used the money of Unsolved Mysteries to find her. He didn't think she ought to go on the program. She wanted to go on the program to validate what her husband had told her. And she did, and it was important to her. I mean, he was dead, so he couldn't go on for himself. He would have, I think. And so people who get dumped on often feel a need to go overboard almost to show that, you know, real world. Well, Kathy found that Betty's story was real in Barney's story.
So where are we now today? Do you feel like that there is yet more to be learned from the Betty Barney Hill experience, or do you believe it's time to move on to new?
Well, events? I think there probably is more to be learned. For example, and it's discussed in the book, the Project Blue Book files got changed, and they crossed out this and changed that. When you find the original studies, the original reports, when Betty first called the base, she called the local police the next day, and they suggested she talk to the people at the base. And she had a long and detailed conversation with the Major Henderson, and the guy called her back, treated her very well and very straight, asked a lot of questions. And so the local people were very intrigued by the situation. They even mentioned to her that there had been a radar event at 2:14 a.m. But then when you get the official records years later, they changed everything. They debunked themselves almost. So it would be nice to get the fuller story on the military records. It would be nice if we found some people who might come forward to say, hey, I was there. We know there were other people around. I mean, it's the middle of the night, but there's always people around.
That's
the
true.
Proof of that is, look at all the people who listen to Coast Radio.
You right. Know, obviously, everybody's not asleep.
Well, I'm asleep at night, but when I do a program there for 3 hours from 3 in the morning till 6 in the morning, my time, and I'm not a night person, but there's obviously lots of people listening. They call in, they order books and stuff. So at first you say, who's up at that time? Well, there are truck drivers up for one thing, and there are prisoners up for another thing. Got a lot of requests from prisoners, you know. So I think there's more to be learned there, but more important perhaps is that gives more opportunities for people who may have been abducted to stick their necks out and come forward. Look, I check all my audiences, Jim, and typically my lecture audiences, typically at the end of my lecture, of course, never at the beginning, 10% believe they've seen something. And they're reluctant to put up their hands, but I cajole them a bit. And then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
That's
and
right.
If people are reluctant to report just a dumb old sighting, how much more reluctant to report something that might involve an abduction? So I hope that the book will encourage more people who may have had an abduction, who may have something to contribute to our knowledge base, to come forward. You know, we're missing a lot of data. One of the things that intrigues me is when you look at this story, you find out little bits and pieces about how aliens behave. You don't often get a chance to look at that, but, you know, that strange, it's a funny scene where they come in, aliens come in who've been with Barney, and they start pulling at Betty's teeth because they don't understand why his teeth come out and hers don't, you know. Now, that's a strange little bit, but obviously they're curious. The fact that they take back the book that they had let Betty keep, saying, we have decided you won't remember, and she gets very upset at that, and she did have the last laugh, because she said, I will too remember. Well, it took a while. But the fact that we have decided, also, they seemed intent on not causing damage or pain. Be kind to dumb animals is the way I put it.
Right, right.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we put a gun in people's back. We put a knife to their throat, whatever, to get people to do what we want. These guys seem to be a little more considerate. Maybe for whatever they're doing, they don't want us to have all the physiological things going on that would get in the way of what they're trying to find out, you know, fear and flight and all that sort of stuff. But whatever it is, I'd like to know more about them. And can you imagine how governments must feel about they'd be salivating at the notion, can we figure out a way to get people to do what we want from a distance without shooting them? You know,
well,
get all the soldiers.
I think they're working on that right now.
Well, you know what I mean.
Psychotronics and sound weapons, non-lethal weapons, as they call them.
Yeah. And I think, so we can understand people being very interested in that, but I think there's more to learn. And what's surprising, I spoke with Terrence Dickinson, the guy who had been editor of Astronomy Magazine, and he's Canada's finest astronomy writer, bar none. He's got several books out, but for 20 years he did a weekly column in the Toronto Star newspaper. But we spoke a few months ago, and considering all the new measurements, all the new data, we both agreed, and he's not a UFO fan, we both agreed that the Marjorie Fish star map work had stood up remarkably well over the years. He was willing to take on Carl Sagan about that. And what bothered me in some ways, reflecting upon that a bit, is that everybody who attacked Marjorie's work misrepresented what she had done and how she did it. Some will say, well, of course all those stars are sun-like stars because that's all she looked at. Well, her big model has 250-some stars in it. And there's only 15 or 20 sun-like stars in the pattern.
Right.
So she didn't only restrict her attention to those. And so there are other things like that, like Carl saying in a Parade Sunday supplement article, making it sound like they'd had one hypnosis session. I mean, there's an awful difference between one and many, many, many weeks of separate hypnosis sessions.
That's correct, but with all due respect to Carl Sagan, it's pretty obvious to me that somewhere along the line, he was brought into the debunker fold. I could cite you several instances where he misrepresented things, but because of his stature, so many people in the public just assumes he's telling the truth.
Well, you're right on about that. And in my book, Top Secret Magic, I quote a number of things he said in Demon Haunted World about UFOs, and he was wrong. And we talked a little bit about it when I was at his home back in the 90s. We went to school together for 3 years, same classes, same age, both from adjacent little towns in New Jersey. And so we talked, and we talked briefly about security. I knew he had had a clearance because he served on a government committee. And we agreed that, well, if he learned something under security, he couldn't say anything about it anyway, and I don't push people under those conditions. It's actually against the law to solicit classified information if you don't have a need to know and an appropriate clearance anyway.
Right.
Yeah, I think he was co-opted, and, you know, people are surprised that Carl wasn't pro-UFO in his public statements. And they also understand when I point out, look, if you want to use radio telescopes, who needs them if somebody's coming here? Maybe you need sign language or something, you know, to communicate with these guys. So the SETI people, and, you know, I feel very strongly about the silly effort to investigate.
So to wrap this up, let me ask you this. I know I was somewhat surprised in researching for my book, Alien Agenda, when I covered the abduction issue, that we mostly hear about people who have a traumatic experience because they go to professionals to try to seek help to find out what had happened to them. We don't hear from almost an equal number of people who've had the same experiences but seem to feel like that they've had a positive experience. And, of course, since they don't feel traumatized or they don't go and seek the professional help, have you found instances of people who've had similar experiences to the Hills but do not report it because they felt like they were kind of special and that was kind of neat, but I don't need the hassle?
Well, yeah, I've certainly found that, and it's been interesting talking to those people. You know, they go with the flow is the only way I can put it, so it happened,
right.
And it's happened more than once, but what's the big deal? I didn't get hurt. You know, I wasn't taken away, never to come back. I seem to have a role in whatever they're doing, and I don't know what it is, but it's not damaging me. I have had people who are very concerned about, they were with a child,
mm-hmm.
And that was scary. What happened, because they were separated on board the craft, and that, the big worry was, what happened to my child?
Mm-hmm.
Then when they get reunited, that takes away the pressure and so forth. But, yeah, I think there's a much bigger spectrum of experience here than we have really heard about, and I hope our book will encourage other people to put forth call it the humanitarian side, a more positive side. Yes, there was terror in the Betty and Barney Hill case. They didn't have anything to look back to. They never heard of anybody being abducted. They had no expectation of how that was going to turn out all right. If somebody grabbed me today, I'd say, take me to your leader, lead me to your
right.
Take. No, anyway.
No, it is interesting how that the public perception has shifted over the years from one of just total disbelief that there's any kind of life outside the earth to today, where most of the polls indicate that a vast majority of people, perhaps even upwards to 80% now, say, oh yeah, sure, there could be life out there. That's quite a change in the public perception.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. Although I've always had a good reception at my lectures, I too perceive a change. And it's funny that the biggest pro argument is that in this vast universe, we can't be the only ones. That's sort of a Carl Sagan argument. But they can read my thoughts on this on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com. I have a piece on Challenge to SETI, for example, the SETI specialists and stuff like that.
Well, the SETI program has always kind of just tickled me, because here they are beaming radio signals into space and listen intently for a reply. And I can't help but think that would be like broadcasting a Morse code message to your neighbor, okay? Your neighbor hears a beep, 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 beep. Does he know what that is? And even if he does know what it is, does he know Morse code? Could he actually read it and return something? I mean, I think anyone out there is probably going to be using communication technology that's far in advance of radio
signals. Yeah, I'll go along with that. All right. I don't think the notion that they're stuck at the same level of technology as we are, and that they're trying to attract our attention. You know, sure, Columbus sent smoke signals to the natives in North America before he got over there. I mean, it's pretty dumb when you think about it, you know.
Pretty dumb. But I do not attack the CD program because, hey, at least they're doing something, and who knows, they might get an answer someday.
Well, I'm not going to hold my breath until they do, you understand.
No, I don't think we should. Stanton Freeman, thank you so much. This has been an interesting hour, and we've learned, we've widened the parameters of knowledge about the Betty and Barney Hill case. And, of course, for those of you who really want the details and really want the hard facts, it's all in Captured, the Betty Barney Hill UFO Experience by Stanton Freeman, our guest today, and his colleague Kathleen Martin, who was the niece of Betty Hill. This is Jim Mars, and we've been with you here on Dreamland, and come back and see us.
You know, William Henry is a very special guy because he's on a quest, and it's a most unusual quest. Now, you can join him in a most unusual way. Recently, he gave an extraordinary lecture, Stargate 2012, Surfing the Tides of the Milky Way. Remarkable lecture at Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny conference. It is loaded with all new 2012 related material. Nobody knows for sure what will happen in 2012, but you can find out some very new ideas from William's latest lecture. You can get it is very simple. Just click on the store tab on unknowncountry.com, then scroll down to the William Henry store. You'll find it and so many other great William Henry items right in that store. Each week I like to feature a favorite charity, and this week we're featuring the National Christian Fund. This is not a political organization, but a genuine charity that supports the needs of the poor. Visit nationalchristianfund.com to learn more about the National Christian Fund and its very important work in the world. You can join the National Christian Fund either locally or nationally. So visit nationalchristianfund.com. Don't miss out on a chance to learn more about a really, really beautiful charity that is doing important, important work in our world. Last week, for our subscribers, we had a report from Andrew Collins in England asking the question, why England? Why is so much strange stuff going on there now? Well, it isn't over. And we're going to be listening to Linda Moulton Howe reporting on some very bizarre and amazing lights that have been seen all over that country in the past few months. Something is going on in England, and you know, to keep up with it, what you have to do is go to Linda Moulton Howe's website, earthfiles.com. She's an Emmy Award-winning reporter for a reason. Earthfiles.com tells you the truth and gives you the facts that others will not. Now, Linda, let's talk about what is happening in England and what just happened last July that we do not yet did just found out about.
On Saturday, July 14th, more high strangeness took place in the English county of Warwickshire at a pub in Shakespeare's hometown of Stratford-upon-Avon. The pub is called the Lone Elm, and it's on Birmingham Road in the center of town. That night, around 10:30 p.m., at least 8 employees, and I talked to a half of them myself, and about 100 people in the pub all watched orange-colored lights move into formation in the sky. The lights stopped absolutely still, and they held a pattern that did not change for nearly a half hour, and there was no sound. One of the pub visitors was Tom Hawks, a local resident who works in customer care for the British Land Rover Company. He had his Olympus digital camera that can take both still frames and up to 40 minutes of videotape with the click of a button. Tom taped at least 5 minutes of those lights. And one of his video frames was used by the Stratford Herald in the first news story about the event. Tom's video, with his permission, I've interviewed him, is now available at a hot link in my earthfiles.com news report about this English pub sighting. Well, about 150 miles southeast in Farnborough, Hampshire, just the next weekend, on August 22nd, on a Sunday, Other eyewitnesses watched and photographed 9 red glowing spheres, which they estimated were about 20 feet in diameter, that suddenly appeared. The words they used were popped in and popped out. They came a few at a time, not all 9 at once, and they moved into various formations before disappearing again, quote, as if you switched off a light, unquote. And I wondered if the 2007 orange lights in English skies might be the same craft that showed up in the United States and Canada 40 years ago. Red-orange fiery spheres of light in the air and near the ground were seen by law enforcement and ranchers all over North America back in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. And eyewitnesses linked the appearances of the red-orange balls of fire to both animal mutilations and intrusions on nuclear missile bases. Over 3 weeks in October to November 1975, several Strategic Air Command bases in the northern states were placed on a high priority alert because of unidentified aerial lights flying at low altitude over atomic weapons storage areas. On October 30th, 1975, at Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Michigan, not far from the Rollaway Campground near Mio, Michigan, on what is called the O'Sable River, low-flying orange lights hovered and moved up and down erratically near the airbase perimeter. Some of the mysterious aircraft were boldly flying and hovering right over the totally restricted nuclear weapons storage area. Now, only 4 months before that, in July of 1975, Richard Johnson and his friend John, in their early 20s, were camping at Rollaway Campground on the O'Sable River in Michigan, which is, he estimates, about 30 miles from the Wirt Smith Air Force Base. The two young men arrived and set up their tents during daylight, and then they went hiking. After their return, they were shocked by what turned up across the river.
As the evening rolled along, we were sitting on these kind of high banks, and the river's quite wide there. And we noticed across the river that we thought someone was camping because there was a large fire. And we hadn't noticed it before. It was like an orange glow. So the next thing we know, this orange ball pops up and goes down above the treetops. And we were looking at each other like, did you see that? And, yeah. Well, this thing popped up and down and came out and came down the river. It was in front of us. And it was probably about 20 feet in diameter. And it was just an orange ball. Now, I can tell you, we were pretty frightened. The hair on my neck was standing up. And I said, whatever it is, it knows we're here. I started talking to it, thinking, well, what are you? What do you want? It was just an orange ball. It looked like it was on fire, you could say, and it moved up to about 2 o'clock on us, like flames, because that's exactly what we thought we saw around it, was flames. It kept coming in towards us and back and in towards us. Of course, we were out in the middle of nowhere. We had nowhere to go.
The orange color, the listeners would know. What would that be?
Kind of like when the sun sets, that kind of an orange. Of course, this was like 12 midnight, you know, so.
And it's close to you.
It was pretty, yeah, it was close. I would say it was probably within 50 yards.
Was it casting any light and shadows on the ground?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't remember, Linda, because, you know, we didn't know what to think.
Right.
We were afraid.
This is spherical as far as you're concerned?
Yes.
Not a disc shape?
No, it was spherical.
Around the sphere, what exactly looks like flames?
Well, when it moved up to the 2 o'clock position, it just seemed like it had these little flames coming off the edges of it. I talked to my friend John about this. He remembers that, too. We thought somebody had a great big fire going over there on the edge of the trees, and that somebody perhaps was camping over there. But all of a sudden, you know, we saw part of the edge of the ball pop up, and then all of a sudden it was bouncing up and down on the treetops, moving to our right. And then it came out down the river to our right and then slowly made its way up and towards in front of us.
So it was doing that bouncing ball look along the trees.
Yes. We were saying, which way is it moving now? And I said, right? He goes, yes, it's right. And then it would go down and come up. So we wanted to verify that we were watching the same thing.
How close did it come to you?
I would say, like, on the other side of the river, which, in my guess, would be 50 yards, no more than 75.
It never crossed the river to you?
No, it just came down.
Okay, now, describe the motion that you were perceiving, that it was coming toward you and then backing up and so forth.
Like I said, it was bobbing up and down the treetop, but when it came out to the river, where it was in full view, it just slowly moved with no bobbing straight in front of us. And then there was no sound.
When you say it moved just straight in front of you, do you mean it's still staying on the other side of the river, or did it cross the river and come right up to you?
No, it stayed over on the other side of the river.
But you could see what you thought was its motion up to the riverbank and then back and then forward and back?
Right.
At any point, did either of you have any telepathic impressions?
I just knew that whatever it was, it realized we were there. And, you know, back then I was 20 years old, and I was just, we did try to communicate with it telepathically. You're correct. We did. We did try to do that. But to no avail. We didn't hear anything or no voices or nothing. But we did try to communicate with it telepathically. I can't believe you said that, because, yes, we did do that.
Okay. And how long did this sort of cat and mouse forward, backward go on?
Well, I want to say it went on for about 40 minutes.
What did the two of you say to each other about what is this?
Well, I had told my buddy John, I said, it has to be a UFO. You know, and it knows we're here. And we, be honest with you, we didn't know. You know, we just didn't know what it was. We just knew that it was something we'd never seen. We said to each other that nobody's going to believe us when we get back. And now, the strange thing about it is, we both don't remember when it left. But we were laying on our backs, and we kind of looked at each other and just went, oh my gosh.
The last memory that you have is you're not standing up anymore, but you're laying down, and the orange sphere is gone, and you're wondering what happened?
Yeah, now see, we were actually sitting on the edge of the bank with our feet over, because the banks were probably about 20 feet high. So we were just sitting on the edge of the bank while looking at the stars and listening to animals, and neither one of us could remember when it left, but I do remember when we were on our backs. And we kind of looked at each other and just, oh, my God. And then we went to our tents and went to sleep.
Hmm. Since that time, which was in July of 1975, have you ever had any truly vivid dreams that included this sphere?
No, I haven't. I've heard of a lot of similar sightings.
What about other vivid dreams of anything that you would put in the category of non-human?
Yes, I've had dreams of UFOs, yeah.
And what happened? What would be the most vivid recollection?
Oh, boy. I remember one dream about UFOs that were, it wasn't good. I mean, it was, I was trying to hide from them, and they were all over the place. I'm not really sure what was going on, but I knew that I had to hide.
In the dream, what are you seeing in the sky when you say they're all over the place? What shapes and how many?
This shaped, you know, I'm trying to go back here. About 10 years.
That's when you had the vivid dream.
Yeah. What 1997, what's important about that date is, you know, I used to watch that show Sightings all the time. I was watching it, and it said in the summer of 1975 that three orange balls came down into three Air Force bases. One that I believe was in Maine, and one was in North or South Dakota, and one was in Wurzburg Air Force Base, which we were not too far from. And it said that three orange balls came in to these Air Force bases one particular night, and that they had disarmed their nuclear weapons, and that they were spotted by several people on the base. And I said, oh, my God, maybe that's what I saw. Because, you know, when we were camping out there during the day, we could see bombers going over. You know, they were doing their runs.
So that night on the river, how far would you have been from that Air Force base?
I'm sure I was within a 30-mile radius.
So what that orange fiery sphere might have been doing that July of 1975 when you and John were sitting on the river, it might have been monitoring the military base.
Correct.
And what you don't know is whether you two were abducted or one of you were abducted.
Right. I don't know that.
In 1997, what vivid dream did you have?
You know, I just remember that I was in a city and it was one of those things where I was just right there all of a sudden, nothing built up to it. There was UFOs flying everywhere and they were saucer shaped. The sky looked kind of grayish. And all I knew is I had to hide. I had to get behind these bushes, and I did. And from what I can remember, there were things walking down the street, which I didn't see, but I just had that feeling that I needed to get down and get out of the way. But I remember just looking up in the sky and saying, oh, my God, there's UFOs everywhere.
What was walking down the street?
I don't know. A presence that I knew I had to hide from, and I couldn't tell what they were. I mean, I don't know if they were grays. I don't know what they were, but I knew I just had to hide.
If you could estimate how many you were seeing in any of your memory, could you talk about it in terms of dozens or hundreds or thousands or whatever?
Oh, I would say dozens.
And the sky being gray sounds as if this is not night.
No. It was like an overcast day. I hid in like this hedge.
Once you're in the hedge, what happens in the dream?
I remember I was just thinking this, something's not right here, and that where did all these UFOs come from, and we're being invaded or something, and so, you know, I got out of that dream pretty quick.
Have you been worrying about the possibility that the dream will come true, the skies will be filled with disks, and that you will have to hide?
You know, I believe that there's probably several people visiting our planet, and some are good and some are bad. But I do believe that we're going through some changes. I don't know if this is any different than what anybody else has ever felt throughout the years, but I just feel that something's going to happen, and I don't know as far as maybe contact and everybody actually knowing what's going on. But, yeah, I have a little anxiety about it, but at the same time, I have a little excitement, too.
It would be nice to get past all the lies and get to the facts of whatever it is that interacts with our planet.
Correct. Because it's been going on for a long, long time. And I believe that the truth's been hidden from us, and we have a right to know.
Back in 1979 to 80, which would not be too long after this event in the Michigan River, I was producing and directing the film A Strange Harvest at the CBS station in Denver. And one of the ranchers that I interviewed remembered the night that he heard his wife scream, "The barn is on fire." And he went running out the door. He grabbed a gun for some reason. And as he hit the ground and he's looking at the barn, he said, "Linda, it looked as if the entire roof of the barn was on fire, and I started running." And he said, "Then I realized that the fire was rising above the roof of the barn, and then the fire was a circle in the sky." And that was one of the farms that had multiple animal mutilations in the 70s. So, Whitley, there is a common denominator through history. The more that we begin to have some kind of perspective on what has happened decade after decade, and now I wonder, why are the orange, fiery-looking lights showing up again?
Well, Linda, we'll find out. That is gonna happen. And yet, at the same time, there's an open-ended quality to all of this. An example, the August 18th and 19th, that those dates were pointed to. Nothing happened. And yet, there's this feeling he just expressed that I have, that you have, that we all have, that something is coming, is going to happen. And all of our listeners, most of the abductees who listen to this show, probably a lot of the other people do, the same thing. Something is out there, kind of just beyond reach, slowly moving toward us.
I feel it, and when you say August 18th to 19th and throw in or go 16th to the 18th, my God, we have this hurricane that was barreling. We had the earthquake in Peru that was so huge.
That's true.
We had
floods, tornadoes. Linda, I'm going to have to stop you.
Financial, near financial meltdown.
Well, you know, you're making a great point. That is a very important point. And guess what? We've come to the end of Dreamland. Never miss a week because this is no longer available anywhere else in the world. Not this depth. This is Dreamland. This is Whitley Strieber. We'll talk to you again next week. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.